Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we look into the research of Dr. Christina Hoff Sommers and specifically her criticism of late 20th century feminism. She's a former philosophy professor and author of several books, including Who Stole Feminism, The War Against Boys, and One Nation Under Therapy. Her recent book is titled Freedom Feminism, Its Surprising History, and Why It Matters Today. We focus in on her book, The War Against Boys, How Misguided Feminism is Harming Our Young Men. It was published in 2000, and Sommers points out how girl crisis advocates were awarded millions of dollars in grants to study the plight of girls. At the same time, however, a pathology of aggression and violence were attributed to millions of healthy male children in the United States. What's troubling is that some of the studies were exposed as being statistically false, yet were adopted by the U.S. Department of Education to set policy standard, the results of which have been implemented as behavioral modules inside the classroom, as the projected image of males are viewed as predators and females as hapless victims. Dr. Christina Sommers joins us to pick up on this topic and assess the impact of the research within the last 17 years. Christina, welcome to Another News.
Nice to be here.
Well, it's been nearly two decades since you wrote The War Against Boys, and that's a good stretch of time to measure behavioral changes in the lives of young men and women. Could you talk about some significant effects observed that could be a result of the resocialization policies you mention in your book?
Well, it's just that the educational needs of boys are neglected. If you are the parent of a boy, it's almost as if the school has a sign, boys not welcome here. That sounds like an overstatement, an exaggeration. I wish it were. It is not.
You point out that no one denies that boys' aggressive tendencies must be checked and channeled in constructive ways. Boys need discipline, respect, and moral guidance. Boys need love and tolerant understanding. They don't need to be pathologized. Can you tell listeners what it is exactly to pathologize healthy male children?
Well, in my research, I found, for example, in a classroom today, it could be a private school or a public school, The preferred play of little boys is rough and tumble play. There's a lot of mock fighting, chasing, bam, boom, sound effects. Now, girls do this too, but they do it a lot less. The preferred play of typical girls, not all girls, but most girls, theatrical, imaginative play, turn-taking games, exchanging confidences with a best friend. Boys don't do that very often. They want that rough and tumble, large motor, active play, and often with fantasies of vanquishing bad guys. Increasingly, in our schools, even in our homes, I mean, there are many mothers that don't tolerate this, but a lot of teachers they like the way girls play, theatrical, imaginative play, playing house, playing school, what could be better? It's peaceful, it appears to be, actually it can be quite complex, but the boys' play is more rambunctious and noisy. It is not aggression. When kids are being aggressive, they part as enemy, there's tears, there's unhappiness. When boys are rough and tumbling, they can hardly suppress their joy. There's just so much happiness, well-being. It's part of their healthy development. Yet we have schools that don't allow rough and tumble play. They don't allow running. They don't allow all sorts of games that boys enjoy. And it even goes so far as, and there's some good data on this, which I review. I won't go into all the footnotes, but in the book I cite studies for any empirical claim. And one claim is that teachers are much more likely to interfere with a little boy's imaginative play than a little girl. And this is thought to be possibly detrimental to their learning because the basis of learning is play. If we start out by disapproving of the play of little boys, and they exist in this milieu of disapproval, this undermines their attachment to school, their attachment to learning, and even their future intellectual development, because kids like to write about what they love. And very often boys will write a story. There was a kid, Justin, in California, who wrote a story about pirates, or actually painted. He drew a picture of pirates vanquishing bad guys. The teacher called his parents in for a conference and said, "I'm worried about Justin. There are pirates in his drawings, and you know, someone was decapitated and so forth." And the parents were shocked. The father said, "He loves pirate stories." Then the teacher knew this too. He was a perfectly well-adjusted, well-behaved little boy. But this was his imaginative world. And the father said something I'll never forget, which is, you know, how can a teacher with so little sympathy for my son's imagination, how can she teach him? Will she be able to teach him?
That is the definition of pathologizing young, healthy male children. And a direct example of misinterpreting their what would be playing as aggression.
Right. They think it's violence. Now, it's violent if a kid threatens another child, if he hits him. That's a whole other thing, and you have to be very clear that won't. And I'm talking about very young boys right now and their imaginative play.
Right.
But it is part of the male psyche. They have these fantasies of heroism and conquering evil. And girls will do that too, but they do it in a different way. They do it, it's a little harder to see, but there are power struggles and vanquishing bad guys and when they play house or school, but it's much more subtle. It's equal but different. And that's one of the messages in my book, is that on average, I'm not talking about all kids, but on average, little boys and little girls are different in the way they play, the things they like. And I think parents and teachers have to respect that. I see a lack of respect for who boys are.
What have you seen as these young male children develop into men and enter into society, the society we're living in now? Do you see an effect of this re-socialization?
You know, kids are resilient. They can put up with a lot. So I'm not going to say that our kids, they're driving them crazy, because it takes a lot to drive someone crazy. But it doesn't take a lot to rob a child, especially a male child, of an education, of his interest in class, in his engagement or connection to school. And what we see is boys, they start out being less connected to school. Typically, they will have a female teachers. They'll see very few men in a preschool or an elementary school. And that would be all right, because boys respond very well to female teachers, provided those teachers like boys. And if they don't, boys know it. And it's not that I think there are a lot of teachers that actively dislike boys, but if they've gone to a typical school of education, they will have learned that masculinity is problematic. And at the first hint of rough and tumble play, they'll think they see toxic masculinity. No, what you're seeing is a healthy little boy acting out his fantasies and playing in ways which are critical to his healthy development, psychological and physical.
You call it a war against boys, and continue to say that the first casualty of war is truth. In the U.S., the truth about boys has been both distorted and buried. How did the plight of boys get to be buried, and by whom?
Unfortunately, what we have in the United States, and there's a good reason for this, but it's really unfortunate. There are hundreds, dare I say thousands, of women's groups looking out for the interests of women and girls. How many organizations are there for men and boys? Very few, almost none. And they risk being called men's rights activists or something, and it's a bad thing, according to critics. So anybody that's working for boys is immediately under suspicion that they're trying to undermine girls. The message of my book, which I wrote a new edition, I rewrote large parts of it and updated it 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And my message is that you don't take away from girls if you help boys. The rise of women doesn't depend on the downfall of men. We're in this together. If boys are in trouble, so are we all. You can't say that if one sex is at risk, then, oh, the other's fine. No, they're both in trouble. The boys are the young men with whom our daughters are going to build a future. So you have to be concerned with how boys are doing. Now, right now, we see every year fewer boys than the proportion of boys going to college is dropping. And girls, it started in the 80s. There used to be fewer girls than boys in college, and that changed in the 1980s, and the girls never looked back. They're on an upward trajectory. And you need education beyond high school in an information economy. And increasingly, girls are getting it, boys are not.
Well, can you talk then about how the distorted research by some of the girl advocate groups hurt women as well as men?
Well, if you go back to the 1990s, there were a series of girl crisis books. There was a study by the American Association of University Women which claimed the girls have lost their self-esteem. Adolescent girls have lost their sense of self. Then there was Reviving Ophelia, and the Sadkers had a book, Peggy Orenstein had a book, all about how girls are being undermined and held back by our society. They were writing these books at a time, and as a philosophy professor for many years, I would see these girls in my classes. I was at a liberal arts college, university, Clark University, and I would see more and more girls in this college and fewer boys. That was happening nationwide. So while girls were winning all the prizes, much more likely to be valedictorian in the honor society, going to college, as I said, all these good things were happening. At that time, we got all these girl crisis books that said, oh no, girls are in free fall. They're in a sort of psychological Bermuda Triangle, according to Mary Piper, Reviving Ophelia author. And the assumption was that they were favored, the classroom's favored boys who dominated discussions. Well, it turned out, I looked for that research that claimed that boys dominate the discussion. There was a showcase factoid used by the girl crisis authors. The Sadker said that when girls call out answers, they get reprimanded. When boys do it, they're praised and encouraged, and that boys do it 8 times more than girls. I could never, several people have tried to find this study. It doesn't, it's never been published. It doesn't seem to exist. Then they changed the numbers. It was all hocus pocus. It was like a lot of this research. I'm sorry to say, the American Association of University Women, they've done a lot of good work, so I hate to criticize them, but when it came to the girl crisis, they lowered their standards. They were carried away with this narrative of short-changed, diminished girls. You know, they wouldn't listen to reason.
What was this publicly brought to them, that some of the information was, difficult to find or non-existent?
Yes. I mean, they broadcast the self-esteem study, and I did a careful evaluation, and others, not just me, Judith Kleinfeld, a psychologist at the University of Alaska, and several journalists, and even Diane Ravitch pointed these things out, and they just dug in their heels and called us, what was the word they used? They called us not only backlashers, but gender bias deniers. And all they did was call names, and they were very angry to be criticized. And I think they just didn't realize how weak the research was and how this was taking attention away from kids. Teachers should be focused on the needs of kids, girls and boys. But what they did was the schools of education followed, and even today, most of the focus is on the needs of girls when girls are approaching 60% of college students.
For the girl advocate groups, they may have accomplished what they set out to do. However, when you go to fix a problem with a bad solution, sometimes it could do more damage. And someone could argue that this is a bad solution with falsified statistics, that this data is being implemented in classrooms and affecting not only young men, but young women. Do you see young women being negatively affected by some of this falsified data?
Yes, because I think it helped to fortify this narrative of that girls are shortchanged, living in a state of siege, undermined by society. The exact opposite was true. There's never been a time where it was better to be a young woman in the United States. They greatly exaggerated the risks. So we have vast numbers of young women in our colleges today who were recipients of this self-esteem training and this sort of victim feminism, and they've come to college. And you may have heard of trigger warnings and the young women demanding safe spaces and monitoring microaggressions, and they have this kind of paranoid attitude towards reality. Well, that was nourished by this alleged crisis of girlhood. So now we do have, you know, young Ophelias in our best colleges who think that they are victims. And, you know, if you tell them otherwise, they get angry, which I did. I lectured at colleges like Georgetown and Oberlin and happened at Yale. I would tell them that there, you know, a lot of these statistics were false, not only the ones about the girl crisis, but a lot of the victim statistics surrounding gender issues. And they got very angry and organized a safe room where they could flee because someone challenging their views they thought was, you know, would cause PTSD, would induce a mental health breakdown. So I think this all came of that sort of the psychobabble and the false politics of the girl crisis.
Well, that's really interesting because I didn't know that. And I think that some of the listeners might be interested in a few specific examples of some of the falsified data, especially if you can trace it all the way back to something that has created the safe space, the trigger warnings, and things like that. Is there anything you can point to for our listeners?
I have to tell you, listeners, and I almost hesitate to say this because it will sound so melodramatic, but almost everything we think we know about gender, we don't know. It's not true because there isn't any real balance of opinion in fields like gender studies, and so you get one-sided view. Now, there are a lot of agendas in universities, but people cancel out one another's agenda. So, you know, you can have all sorts of doctrinal feuds in a philosophy department or a history department, but that will get settled in the scholarship. They have a system of quality control. It's called criticism. This system has broken down in gender studies, in the studies of girls, in education. It has broken down because critics are called backlashers. They're disqualified. If you criticize, that just shows you're part of the patriarchal, oppressive society. Take the, and this is related to the girl crisis, take the wage gap. How many times have we heard that for the same work, women earn 79 cents for every dollar a man earns? Now, that is technically true. I mean, it's technically true that there is a wage gap, but it's not for the same work. And when economists, including some feminist economists, look at the data and they control for what is for your college major, for your length of time in the workplace, what sector do you work in, that sort of thing. Hours worked per week, that's a very big one. When they do all of that, the wage gap narrows to the point of vanishing. But you never hear that from the women's groups. So young women learn that when you enter the workforce, you can plan to be cheated out of about 25% of your salary. That's just one. That's one sort of the mother of all misleading statistics. Now just think about it. If an employer could hire women for almost 25% less than it would cost to hire a man, that would drive men out of the workplace. Men would hire, everyone would hire women to make a huge savings. It hasn't happened, and the reason it hasn't happened is that it can't happen because that whole wage gap claim, as it's the way they explain it, is misleading. And they make it look like an injustice when it really has to do with things like college majors. Girls are much more likely, if you look at the college majors, and this hasn't changed much over decades, girls are much more likely to major in fields like psychology, social work, education, liberal arts. The boys, most popular majors are fields like engineering, economics, and business. Now, you will make more money if you major in economics, or if you major in petroleum engineering, you will make more money than if you major in social work. And there's a big difference in college majors, but that's just one factor. Men work more hours per week.
Aren't they talking about the women, men and women in the same field?
Yes, if you look at the same field, two petroleum engineers, a man and a woman. Again, you still have to factor in how many hours a week do they work? Were they willing to relocate for a higher salary? To, you know, did they decide to go to the the best paying municipalities? And you find men are more likely to do that. They're more likely to work overtime and, you know, crazy hours. It's the majority of the people who work 70 hours a week or something are men. Well, that will drive up your income. And even in a field like engineering, you say, oh, well, even female engineers earn less. Well, they're more likely to go into the less remunerative specialties. You have to consider those things. Have you heard of this program, Freakonomics? It's on NPR. Somewhat liberal, but basically very objective and solid. And then a few weeks, well, now it's a few months, they had a Harvard economist who is herself a feminist. And but she explained that there's no smoking gun. It's not that you can find, you know, you're not going to find employers deliberately cheating. She said that it all has to do with what she called temporal flexibility, that the jobs where you're going to see a big gap are where the employer, like in a law firm, where they greatly value someone who can just work nonstop, you know, weekends, and, you know, where there's a huge premium on that kind of being a workaholic. And women will drop out of fields like that or avoid them more than men. Some mm-hmm. women do it, and that's why we always have to be, you know, careful. And when they do, they are in the same as men. But
well, this is a really good example, Christina. And I would ask also here that is this valuable information for women?
Absolutely. And that's what I always consider myself a feminist. And I think it is very discouraging to be told you're a young woman and to be given this litany of bad news when the opposite is true. If you want to be a high-powered lawyer, you know, tell them the truth. You'll have to go to a good law school. You'll have to specialize in a lucrative specialty and then work like mad. And a talented young woman who's willing to work like that, law firms would compete for her. And that's the thing. Women who go into engineering and they're willing to work like that, what you want to look at is not just the statistics, who's doing what. You want to look at, are people able to do what they want to do? And are they succeeding? And again, you know, with the stipulation that there are some backwaters out there. But overall, systemically, I defy any economist or, you know, serious researcher to show systemic discrimination against women. They won't find it. What they will find is that men and women are somewhat different, and women have a slightly more tenuous connection to the workplace. They're more willing to drop out when, you know, or pull back when they have kids, mm-hmm. and men tend to work more when they have children. Now, at that point, some will say, aha, but that's still sexism. Why are the women staying home and the men, you know, working more? That's sex roles. To that, I think, you know, reasonable people can differ. Is it just sex roles, or is it partly who we are? Are men and women somewhat different in terms of, you know, domestic attachment and, you know, wanting to parent, you know, take care of babies and so forth? I do see a difference, always mentioning many exceptions, but there are very good studies. Even the Pew Research Center, and this was done also by Catherine Hucking at London School of Economics, found that about 20% of women aspire to be full-time careerists. Like any high-powered man, they're the same. About 20% want to be homemakers and not work at all. And then 60% are in between. They're called, I guess Hakeem calls them adaptives. They go in and out of the workplace. Mm-hmm. And when they have children, they pull back. They want to work part-time. And I think that we'd be all better off if we had a women's movement that could accommodate what women actually want, what men and women want, and to work together to have it. But instead, they just want women to be careerists, and that is not where most women are or want to be.
Okay, well, that's a really, really good example of some of the falsified statistics, and I'm wondering if you can give us another one that can relate maybe directly to the safe spaces and what's happening now to the younger generation.
This is the other amazing thing. If you go to a campus, and I'm talking about some of the most elite, prestigious, expensive campuses, a Swarthmore, Yale University, Wesleyan, the young women are told that they're entering a rape culture. And they are given statistics that make it seem as though they're the threat to their lives, equivalent or worse than, you know, the war-torn Congo, that they're entering, you know, or like Bosnia during the war where they had rape camps. They're making it seem like Swarthmore. This is utter madness. But they tell them they have a 1 in 4 or a 1 in 5 chance of being attacked by the boys in the school. And, I mean, it's not to say that there aren't horrible things that happen, because there is a binge drinking culture and there's a lot of miscommunication. And there are some criminals. It's not, you know, 25% of girls being raped. That's ridiculous.
So we're seeing another exaggeration here. And I'm curious, okay, before we get into the effects of that, who benefits from this?
You know, I don't know that the people who promote this, the people who promote this believe it. For the most, most people don't deliberately lie, and they're not deliberately lying, but I think they're self-deceived. I think they have created a world that is a fabrication. I've watched this happen over the years through gender studies, where they take young women, freshman year, and tell them that, you know, all the women in the society are at grave risk of being battered, of being raped, and dying of eating disorders caused by men's patriarchal standards of beauty. And then if they survive all that, they're going to be cheated out of as much as a quarter of their salary, on and on. So naturally, a fair number of young women become activists, and they want to stop the rape culture, they want to bring down the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. Except there's one problem. There is no patriarchy. There is no rape culture. And even the wage gap is a wild exaggeration. So there's a body of egregiously false information that sustains this mythic world. But apparently it's attractive in some way to inhabit that world. I didn't think it was. I thought that this whole thing, years ago, I thought it would fall by the weight of its own absurdity to call the freest country among the freest in the world, and where most opportunities and where women are treated so well, and in some ways better than men, in many ways better. I think it's impossible to say who's better off or worse off. It depends on the area, and overall, it's a complicated mix of burdens and benefits when you look at men and women. If there is male privilege, I'm sure there is in some areas, but there's female privilege in the United States. It's complicated, and both sexes have it pretty good overall. Not that there aren't individual exceptions, but as group, I can't think of a society where it's much better.
Have you talked with feminists who've gone into the activist end of things and stumbled into the false research and realized that, wait a minute, things aren't as I was told?
Well, I think what's happened now is that one of the things that they teach in gender studies is that the men and women are exactly the same, that the differences are just incidental biological differences, that we're cognitively interchangeable. So they are able to go out in society and say, aha, this proves the society isn't fair, because there are, you know, more male CEOs than females, or more male engineers, or more male senators. Well, what they fail to do is notice that there are also more males at, you know, that's at the very high end of achievement. But if you look at the low end, there are far more males. On average, you find more males who are in prison or, you know, living on the street, that sort of thing, failing out of school. You find more males And the reason the men are becoming CEOs, and it's not because the society is favored in their favor, it's the society favors workaholics with degrees in fields like engineering, you know, or computer science. And then you can be a CEO, I mean, or, you know, go very far if you're brilliant at that. Now, if you're a woman, you can go very far if you're brilliant at that. Even you probably have advantage, and we have some good studies that show there is advantage for women with those skills when they apply for jobs or even professorships. There's very good research to show that they're not held back, they're advantaged. But what the current activists do is they say, well, until there's, you know, 50% gender statistical parity, then it must be discrimination. They don't allow for the possibility that the sexes, that it, you know, in pursuing happiness, men and women take somewhat different paths, which is what I think.
Right. And getting back to what has influenced the Safe Spaces and the Trigger Warnings group, and you've been studying this area and researching it and speaking about it. What can you tell listeners about this emerging culture?
It's a culture of madness. It's paradoxical. You have these young women who are the most privileged who think they're oppressed. They honestly think they, you know, they share a fate of, you know, it's not that they don't feel bad for women who are at the mercy of the Taliban or, you know, not allowed any rights in Saudi Arabia. They think that their plight is a little different but similar. So they believe these absurd things. They believe that they're in mortal danger of being assaulted. I mean, I don't know if they really believe, but they, at least they believe that's happening to everybody else because they've read these statistics, or many other people, they've read these statistics. So they get a very paranoid view of the world. And once they are there, they become very angry. And you can understand it. If these things were true, think about it. If a quarter of girls were being raped on our college campus, what parent would send them to that college if there was a 25% chance that, you know, some horrific crime was going to happen? But they believe it, and it seems that they can't be talked out of it once they have taken one too many gender studies courses.
So you can attribute specifically some of these courses that fuel trigger warnings in the Safe Spaces.
Well, yes, because they're all traumatized. They think they are. They think that this probably connects to, I think more of this is happening because of what's going on in the elementary schools. They, you know, the girls learn that they're being robbed of their self-esteem and mistreated. So they, as soon as they get to college, and they, even if a speaker comes who challenges some of their cherished opinions, they take that as an assault, as a kind of violence, because here they are, you know, they're convinced that we live in this dangerous, violent, patriarchal society. They want to bring it down. How dare you suggest that it's not as bad as it is? And I don't just suggest it's not as bad as it is. I say it doesn't exist. What they're describing is an illusion.
Wow.
And the Empress is threadbare. And then you say, well, how could that happen? How can so many people believe it? The way it happened, and I watched it over many years, is that the mistakes didn't get corrected. No one came forward and said, well, I mean, some people did, but the media didn't listen. And by now, I guess if you're a male journalist and you correct the wage gap, as a very fine journalist, Glenn Kessler, a fact checker at the Washington Post, he has done a good job correcting it and explaining it. But a lot of male professors have just run for cover because you'll just be called sexist. And a lot of female professors who might be themselves be feminists, they don't really want to get involved, or maybe they think it's true, maybe it's true for other people. They don't really look into it. And you immediately be called a crank or a right-wing nut if you correct this misinformation. So there's no way to correct it. And it's gone on for so long, and that's why I say it is an emperor's new clothes situation. And sooner or later, it's all going to come falling down, but now we've created a lot of rancor between men and women. There's so much anger at boys. I mean, I talked about, earlier in the interview, I talked about this environment of disapproval little boys face in elementary school. Well, it's even worse when they get to college. If they make it to college, it's sort of a, some have called it a pink police state, and where male sexuality is, it's It used to be the case, and it still is many places, where like gay sexuality was pathologized, and any gay person was considered toxic or dangerous, or now hopefully we're past that, but it seems to be open season on heteronormative males, and we've just switched and we're demonizing them, calling their sexuality toxic and it's under a cloud, and I didn't want any of this. I mean, I came as a sort of free spirit from the 1960s, a flower child, but I became a philosophy professor. I just never lost my classical liberalism and my, I still believe in women's emancipation, but I don't believe in a grievance culture based on propaganda. That seems to me to be fanatical, authoritarian, the opposite of liberation. And none of this is liberating for girls. It's stultifying and diminishing.
I'm wondering, regarding the rape issue and those statistics, and when you bring in some clarity on some of the stats to some of the students, what feedback do you get from that?
Some of them will say, oh, God, you're right, because this isn't happening, and, I know it. But others are just furious. And what worries me is that they are enlarging the meaning of sexual assault and rape to mean things that, for example, if two people are drunk, a drunken hookup, I'm not talking about someone being incapacitated or just, like dropping over because they're so drunk. I'm just talking about if both man and woman at college have had a few drinks and they have a hookup. Is that rape? I would say, of course not. They would say, I was a rape denialist to say that a woman can't consent under the influence of alcohol. And I find this infantilizing to women and disrespectful. It takes away agency. And you are responsible for what you do and the choices you make. If you've had some drinks, that's why we hold you responsible. If you take the keys of a car, if you get into a hookup, you can't later say, and again, there are things that happen where there is a violent act and you're passed out. But if you consent and you go along with it and later, your gender study says, well, you had drinks and you went along with it, but you didn't really want to, and maybe he talked you into it. I've seen, there are young women now that think that if someone talks you into sex when you didn't, you were ambivalent, that that's an assault. Now, I don't think it's necessarily a gentlemanly thing to do, to talk somebody into sex, but it happens. It's not rape, because you always have your agency unless you're a child. Then, of course, we would view it differently. But if it's an adult woman and someone makes false promises, you don't call it rape. You might call it, as I said, some kind of reprehensible behavior, but not a crime. And I'm finding on campuses they're enlarging the meaning. So as they do more studies on campus, they may eventually, if they ask the right questions, they're going to find their epidemic, because they change the meaning of the word. Now, again, I think this, by trivializing this hateful, frightening crime, I think that it sort of dilutes the whole thing and trivializes it.
Well, that's interesting, too. The false information is hurting men and women, and it doesn't seem to be benefiting anyone. What's interesting here is how it's in the United States, and I don't know about Canada, but you mentioned that in Great Britain, there's a different environment for young men. And could you explain that dynamic for listeners?
Well, they have a big problem there, too, because one of the things the listeners should know is that boys are way behind in our national assessments on reading and writing. We hear that they have an advantage in math and science, but that's just by 1 or 2 points. There's a huge gap in reading and writing. And reading is the sort of gateway skill to all other skills. If they don't read at the right level, grade level, they are in trouble. And so Britain has a large and growing number of young men who are barely literate and, as I said, are not going to find a place for themselves in the information economy. Mm-hmm. So what Great Britain is doing is kind of massive, sort of a literacy intervention. And at the level of the government, they've sent out reading lists of books that are loved by boys. irresistible to boys. These are, and they require that every teacher have the list. We don't do anything like that. If you did, people would say, oh, that's, you know, the AAUW would complain, or the National Organization for Women would complain. So they're looking at the problem. They're doing more experiments with male teachers and single-sex classrooms and male-friendly pedagogy and using more, trying everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not going to be easy because it turns out it's just harder to educate a boy than a girl. On average, boys are less happy to be there in the classroom. They're less engaged from day one. And it's partly what I said before, their preferred style of play. They kind of want to be outdoors running around. They feel like caged animals. Anyone who's had a son will know what I'm talking about. And yeah. The girls, you know, they go there and they're, you know, some little girls will experience it as being caged too. But on average, they're happy there and they want the teacher to like them and, you know, they like the assignment. They're, you know, so it's almost as if our classrooms are increasingly run by women and for the benefit of girls.
You mentioned that boys, on average, are a year and a half behind girls in reading and writing in this country, and less committed to school and less likely to go to college. So you're saying that those stats are similar in the UK?
They're similar or worse.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, for their, I think it's their working class boys. They're just in a kind of educational freefall and not keeping up.
From doing all this research, and now it's you know, nearly two decades again, how do you see young men brightening their prospects?
Well, assuming they can get through elementary school and not be completely disenchanted, and then get through high school and get into a good, you know, college, and get through this world of angry women and bitter gender studies teachers and increasing numbers of Title IX officers and gender facilitators and all of that. It's all part of what some have called the pink police state on campus. So they have that to look forward to. If they can get through that, they'll be all right. It's because this hasn't yet found its way into the workplace, although I'm waiting for that to happen. Because some of these young women that are so carried away with being grievance collectors, they're going to go into the workplace now. They'll take their safe space trigger warning mentality with them into the workplace and might demand change. And, you know, if there's a small vocal group making all sorts of demands, people don't want hassles, so they go along with it. So it could change workplace, unless we stop it. But I'm not sure we will, because I thought it would be stopped long before, and it's gotten worse. All of the shenanigans.
Well, Christina, why did you think it was going to be stopped? How were you thinking that would happen?
I think as a philosophy professor and someone who believes in the power of logic and reason, I believe that would prevail. I did not understand just the power of kind of tribal mentality, and that myths that served a purpose with, you know, that appealed to emotion, could be quite durable. And so it's almost like something like the wage gap or the fact this girl's self-esteem crisis, this sort of thing, even though they're not true, they're almost beyond rational analysis because they've been repeated so many times.
That's the function of propaganda, as many know. Now, you write a lot about Carol Gilligan in this book, and you really pick apart her research, who I suspect is one of the primary researchers that is causing some of these issues here with young women. Can you give listeners an overview of her and what you've extrapolated from her work?
Yeah, she was sort of the beginning of this idea that girls lose their self-esteem and fall down in what was her metaphor, the sea of Western culture, something like that. They hit the wall of Western culture,
mm-hmm.
which has been actually quite empowering to women. But we're not dealing with reality here. We're dealing with fantasy. And in her, she spun a fantasy about girls losing their voice. They were outspoken and perky at 7, and then they become silent and diminished in adolescence. Where is the evidence of that? I mean, girls change and probably become somewhat more reflective, and maybe all kids go through some awkward periods in adolescence, but where is the evidence that they're diminished or shortchanged or miserable and depressed? And she painted this picture, and it was just based on some interviews she did at a private school. And then she spun this through some literary theories and psychoanalysis, and suddenly we had a full picture, which was distorted. She gave the nation a distorted picture of its children. And she had credibility because she was at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, but no one bothered to look at where she had published her research and whether or not it was taken seriously by experts in, you know, adolescent psychology. Experts in adolescent psychology didn't know what she was talking about. They had not documented these trends. And so we haven't heard from her in a few years. I think she's doing something else. I think she wrote a book on love or something. She's not. I don't know what she's doing lately. But she did leave Harvard and go to, I think, NYU, to the law school.
How influential was her research on...
Oh, you can't overemphasize. She started the girl crisis. And I think it was because people thought... She had written a kind of interesting book, although taken apart by a lot of clinical psychologists and developmental psychologists. She'd written this book on a different voice about differences between men and women. That book had a lot of problems, but it was very popular. And she was from Harvard, so that gave her a lot of cachet. So I think that, you know, these nice women at the AAUW, I think they saw her name and she was claiming girls were in crisis. And I think they thought they had, you know, like a Nobel laureate from Harvard doing, you know, this groundbreaking research, except that there wasn't any research. There was just theorizing and victim politics and sort of a lot of metaphors, but no reality.
Well, this research that you've done here in this book, and I'm sure in your other books, but this one in particular, it's very important to put a balanced perspective on what's going on, and then the hindsight is very important as well, looking at it now 2 decades later, and here's what we have, specifically in the United States. That's very interesting. I might ask you, what got you started in researching this particular area?
Well, you know, years ago, I was teaching philosophy, and this was a long time ago, giving away my age here, but I don't care. I'm not. But I would say in the mid-80s, the chair of my department asked me to teach a course on feminist philosophy, feminist theory. And, you know, it was sort of just getting started. And I was a philosopher and feminist and a theorist. And so I sent away for the textbooks. And I was appalled by the lack of any, you know, intellectual diversity. It was all kind of paranoia. Views about the patriarchy, very paranoid views about American society, and it just didn't seem to be based on reality. So I just wrote a paper refuting some of the more extreme views in feminist theory, and I went to the American Philosophical Association and gave the paper. And often you give a paper, and you know it's very contentious, and then you go out for drinks. We did not go out for drinks. I gave this paper, and these feminist philosophers were furious. They were hissing as I was speaking.
Ooh.
So it was very awkward. And it just angered me that I saw that they weren't willing to respond with argument, and they seemed to want to silence me or bully me or something. And that just bothered me, so I just kept writing, and I wrote a paper about it, and The Atlantic had read it and asked me to write for them, and so I did. And so I went from being a professor to more of a journalist and writing for a larger audience, because I wasn't getting much of a response from the feminist philosophers. But then I wrote a book. First I wrote a book called Who Stole Feminism, and then The War Against Boys, and then a book called One Nation Under Therapy. I wrote a little monograph about the sort of feminism I believe in that puts liberation and joy at the center, not grievance and anger at men. Why should we be angry at men? I have two sons, and I loved my father, and there are so many good men. Yes, I know you can point to, you know, I would say this to young women. They would say, well, this sexist professor said this to me, and I said, I'm sure he did, but how many really nice professors encouraged you? How many really nice men, you know, be reasonable? And they, you know, they would often agree with that, that they have known a lot of nice men, but this field depends on the demonization of males. And that's just wrong. That's bigotry. That's gender profiling. I'm against it.
If listeners want to get in touch with you or get more information about your work, how do they do that?
Well, they can, first of all, they should listen to The Factual Feminist. I have a YouTube show, supposedly once a week, although I haven't been doing it that often, but I've got videos where for 5 minutes or so, I'll just correct a feminist myth, give the best sources I can. So they'd want to check out The Factual Feminist. They could follow me on Twitter at CH Summers. I haven't checked lately, but I think I have over 100,000 followers, so there are people interested in hearing these myths corrected, and people sometimes dispute me and send me articles for me to consider, and I will do it whenever I can. So follow me on Twitter, CH Summers, listen to The Factual Feminist, and I'm at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.
Well, Dr. Christina Summers, I really appreciate you going through some of these critical details in your book, The War Against Boys, and I thank you for being on In Other News.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archived shows.
Close your eyes. Monster's gone, he's on the run, and your daddy's here. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Before you go to sleep, say a and better. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Out on the ocean, sailing away. Thank you. shore.